they were only walking a few feet between one tent perhaps here and the other tent here. And in those few yards that we walked, that was the closest I've ever come to on any expedition to thinking I was going to die.
Welcome to The Human Beat. I'm Roger Rocca. The voice you just heard is that of Sue Stockdale, one of the first women ever to trek to the magnetic North Pole, and the first from Britain. Sue spoke in Astoria at the Cannery Pier Hotel and was introduced by Kathleen Sullivan.
She is a polar explorer and author and an inspirational speaker who's probably done more things than most of us will even think about doing. In 1996, she became the first British woman to ski to the magnetic North Pole. She's done expeditions to Chile, Antarctica, Geographic North Pole, and Greenland. She's an athlete. She also has a business career. And I didn't know this existed, an MBA in entrepreneurship.
Yeah.
And an MSc in quality management accredited coach.
This afternoon, I'm going to talk about skiing across the Greenland ice cap, a journey that I did in 1999, where there were four of us from three different countries, two men and two women, with the one common aim of skiing around 350 miles across the Greenland ice cap. Now, Greenland, I don't know if any of you have been to Greenland, but it certainly doesn't live up to its description, because it isn't green, and it's not flat either. Most of the country is covered by an inland ice cap. At the highest point, it's over 2 miles thick. And our expedition would be starting and finishing at sea level and in between skiing to a height of over 8,000 feet. So it'd be two-thirds uphill and one-third downhill.
The seeds of adventure were planted for Sue when she was only 16 years old. We talked with Sue after her speech. And in this program, we're going to move back and forth between the speech and the interview.
Yes, I was represented Scotland in track and field, in athletics, 3,000 metres in cross country. And I think what I learned from that first experience was the ability to be disciplined and to focus on an end goal and to work hard every day with a view that hopefully you'd achieve something really positive at the end of it. Well, I was 16 years old, and the reason I got into athletics in the first place, it captured my interest, was because the PE teacher, physical education teacher at school, her husband was Alan Wells, and he was a British runner that won the Olympic gold medal in 1980 in the 100 metres in Moscow. And he came to our school after his success and showed us his gold medal. And his wife was my physical education teacher, and she then encouraged me. I presume she saw some sort of talent, so she encouraged me to join the local athletics club, and it went from there.
Was it the gas company you worked for?
Yes, I started there when I was 16, right from school. Even though I had great grades and could have gone on to college, I decided to get a job and earn money and see a bit of life. And during that time, I saw an advertisement. The company was sponsoring a number of employees to take part in an expedition to go to a remote country in the world that was organised by a charity based in Britain. And you spent 3 months in this remote part of the world carrying out scientific, community and adventure projects. Well, the big attraction for me was that while you were away, you got your salary paid. So it seemed like a 3-month holiday to me. So I applied to join one of the expeditions and eventually was selected as one of the company corporate-sponsored employees. That took me to Kenya back in 1988, and really that gave me the real taste for adventure. Well, it was several years later, I was reading the newspaper and I saw an advertisement to join a team of novices, people that were inexperienced, to ski 350 miles to the magnetic North Pole. Well, I just thought, what a great chance to go and see if I can survive in the cold, because I didn't know if I could, and probably most people wouldn't want to find out. Perhaps coming from Scotland, you know, I was a bit used to it. Anyway, I had to go through a whole series of selection tests and eventually was selected as one of the team members. Ironically, after I got in the team and was fundraising to pay for my place on the expedition, I obviously had to have a good case for sponsorship from companies and so on, and I discovered that if successful, I would be the first British woman to get there. And ultimately, our team was successful, and that was the accolade that I received. So that particular expedition really did change my life, because having that recognition of being the first in that way, nobody can take that away from you.
It sort of changed your career path as well, did it not? Because now you are a consultant, you are a lecturer, and you talk about how people can achieve what they want to achieve in life. So what was the progression from there after your first trek to the magnetic North Pole?
Well, because I never imagined that it was possible for me to achieve something like that, and I had done it, I didn't just want the experience to be photographs in an album and nice memories for me to think about later. I wanted to use that experience to be more purposeful. So I thought, well, you know, wouldn't it be great to be being able to speak about those experiences and inspire other people to get to their North Pole equivalent? Mm-hmm. They don't have to go to a cold place, but they're able to challenge themselves to see what they're capable of. And I found that I was good at it. I had a bit of practice, and I put together my first presentation and shared it with somebody whose opinion I valued. And she said, yes, I think you could be a decent speaker. And so therefore I set up my own business and went about deciding to be a motivational speaker. After the North Pole, then, as you can imagine, there was a lot of press attention, there was a lot of interest in the expedition afterwards. And I suppose I sat back and got complacent, and I thought opportunities would come to me. Well, I think it's a great lesson that one learns in life, that if you do that, the opportunities don't always come to you. You do have to work at them. And I realised eventually that I had to take the initiative. I had to be proactive and get back out into the world of work and do something that would earn me money. And along the way, I remembered about this charity that I'd been to Kenya with all these years before, that they always need volunteer members of staff to help on the expedition, because you might have 100 or 120 young people from all over the world, and they need experienced people who can help lead the expedition. So I also thought, if I did that and helped other people on an expedition, it might give me some confidence back, so that I could use my leadership skills, my capabilities, and help to see other people come through and hopefully get a similar experience to what I had had. So in doing that, I rang them up, and they luckily said, we need somebody to go to Chile 3 weeks from now, deputy expedition leader. And they knew about my experience, so they offered me that post. And it was whilst in Chile that I suddenly thought, well, here I am almost at the other end of the world. You know, wouldn't it be great to get to Antarctica in the same season as going to the Arctic? And during that time, my sister back in Scotland had sent me a letter, and she was keeping in touch with me. Included in one of her letters was a newspaper cutting talking about a polar expedition that a guy called Robert Swan, the first man to walk to both the North and the South Pole, that he was organising to sail down to Antarctica to take 35 young people from 25 countries to go and experience Antarctica. Really to inspire them to ensure that Antarctica remains pristine for the future and doesn't become a place that doesn't belong, or that belongs to somebody rather than to nobody. So I saw this newspaper cutting, and therefore I thought, well, maybe I could help in some way on this expedition as well. So I sent off my details to him. I'd never met him before, and I just put together probably a convincing resume. And before I knew where I was, they had asked me to be a leader on that expedition. So I do think that when you take one risk and you take one step into the unknown, then sometimes luck will come along as well. And one step will give you confidence, the next opportunity then presents itself. And that's what's happened to me.
Back to Sue's talk at the Cannery Pier about her trek across the Greenland ice cap.
What I also was going to find of interest was the idea of us coming together and having to work as a team. Because in my normal job, when I'm not speaking, I do a lot of leadership and team development work with corporate clients. And one of the things that I always look for is, how can you bring together people from different environments, different cultures, and work very quickly together as a team? And this was going to be a great opportunity for a case study. Now, the things that were going to be of interest to me were things like, well, what are our strengths and our weaknesses? What are our hopes and our fears? So we start off day one, all our sledges packed, weighing around, it's about 60 kilograms, that's about 130 pounds, I would say the weight of an average person. You're dragging this sledge for 8, 9, even 10 hours a day on your back. So it's very physically demanding work, and you're wearing skis at the same time that have a fish scale type material at the bottom that enables you to push forward without sliding backwards as you're skiing uphill.
It's often too cold to speak to anybody else. You're skiing in single file, and the only visual reference you have is white all around. Mm-hmm. So we forget in normal civilization how external stimulants can keep us interested. Birds flying in the air, the river flowing by, flags flying, whatever it might be. We can be attracted by many different things, even the colour of the clothes we're wearing. When you take away all of those external stimulus in terms of colour, and you take away the stimulus of speaking to somebody else, then the only thing that's keeping you motivated is what's going on inside your head. And that becomes a real mental battle. So sometimes we were all of a reasonable level of fitness, the four of us on this expedition, but we all had varying speeds of skiing. And there began after a few days to be a sense of frustration because some people were fitter than others and they wanted to go faster. And that caused a level of conflict. So whilst you're going along, certainly for me, when you have a level of confidence, you can be saying to yourself, as I was, yes, of course I'm good enough. I can keep up with everybody else. This is no problem. However, as soon as you start to doubt your capabilities and you think, maybe I am the slowest, maybe I can't take my share of the weight in my sledge, maybe I'm not good enough to be on the team, that will then impact on your skiing speed. You'll get slower, and of course then that will impact on the overall performance of the team. So that's where I've learned a lot from my world of expeditions and from athletics, is the power of your mind over your performance. And we've seen that obviously in the recent Olympics, watching all those great athletes perform, and those often that get the mental game right on the day will be the ones that are the medalists.
After a couple of more days, we reach the area that's probably the most dangerous in the entire expedition, that's the crevasse zone. So at the edges of the ice cap, you have big chasms that are covered by snow and ice, and you can be skiing across them, and all of a sudden, the ice and snow could give way, and you could plunge potentially to your death in a giant chasm. Now, two things that we'd all agreed to. One thing was that safety was more important than getting there. And the second thing was to start and finish as friends. So when it came to safety, we were all roped up together. So like a giant snake. And that means that if somebody falls into a crevasse, the rest of you are still on the surface, and the rope that they are attached to, they can then pull themselves out of the chasm because you're all attached together.
So it does take a level of experience, and it is quite a difficult thing to do, to learn how to navigate through those areas. That really calls for a level of attention to detail, to notice the subtleties of the colour of the ice and the way the wind direction might be blowing the snow, which may then have got much thicker in one part than another. And just to pay attention to those very small details will make the difference. And I did make that point during my talk, is we rarely think about attention to detail. The important thing I've learned in life and in work is paying attention to the right details.
On day 28, the Greenland expedition was stopped by a huge storm.
So we take our sleeping bags and we embark outside. Now we're only walking a few feet between one tent perhaps here and the other tent here. And in those few yards that we walked, that was the closest I've ever come to on any expedition thinking I was going to die. There was just no wind, there was no air to breathe at all outside. The wind was swirling around so strongly that you just couldn't get a breath of air at all. So we immediately jumped into the tent with the other two, and we thought, oh my goodness, I wish we'd built that snow wall a little bit more substantially. What are we going to do now? If our tent blows away, we've had it. We're really all going to die. It took us 36 hours of staying in that tent together and all having to think about just basic survival, hoping our tent wouldn't blow away, until the wind died sufficiently that we were able to leave.
And in those situations, you are just thinking about survival from minute to minute. It's not even thinking about the following day. It's just, it does bring life into its simplest focus. And then I've certainly realised that you again have to just focus on the positive and what you can do, rather than thinking, oh my goodness, we're going to die. You have to be operating in the present and focusing on that. And I think that example of being in the present and thinking about what's possible, I can think of it just directly from one of the chapters of our book where we've talked about that type of thing. That if people are getting panicky and thinking, oh, what if this and what if that, and their mind can race ahead with all the things that might go wrong in a situation in work, then they're less likely to be performing at their best and to feel a sense of control. What we certainly learned, and I know Clive has in his driving as well, is to have the ability to focus on the present and what is and what is possible at that time, and to think about the positive. Mm-hmm. And those things that what I think I've been able to do is extract that learning from those personal experiences I've had and try and then equate them back to the world of work and to help other people learn about those things and to apply those skills for themselves.
Yes, the new book, I co-authored the latest book. This is my third book with Clive in the corner there, who's my partner. We've both written it together. It's called Cope with Change at Work. And the reason I've written it, because there's loads of books about change and lots of books about managing change from the perspective of managing other people, but there's not so much written about people who have to be on the receiving end of change when they aren't in control of making that change. So the book's all around how do you cope with those situations in work when you're receiving the change and not doing it. And a lot of the learning in that book is very similar to what I've learned on expeditions. It's about, you know, the mental strategies as much as anything else that can really help us in normal life, if you like, as much as we can learn on expedition. And you can, you know, if you're interested, SueStockdale.com is my website. You can get more information there.
Well, those treks to some very cold places have also taken you to some nice warm places. I think you told me you have been on 24 cruises now as a speaker.
Yes, it's rather the luxurious side of what I do.
What are some of the places you've been to on the cruises?
Well, I have been back to Chile, which I particularly enjoy, but more hot. I've been over to Australia, New Zealand, the Mediterranean many times, and to the Far East as well. So it's a great way, again, even if people that are on cruise ships as paying passengers like to be entertained. And I do hope, and I know from my experiences, that they enjoy the lectures that I give about all the different adventures that I've had. Again, in a little way, trying to inspire them to maybe do something that's a little bit out of the ordinary for them.
In addition to consulting and lecturing, you've also become a writer, and you have how many books out now?
I have the third book is about to be published, and then I have another two that will be coming out in the next few months.
You had a little help on the third book from, I guess it takes one to know one, another person who's kind of an adventurer and who is now your partner in life, Clive Steeper. Clive, hi and welcome.
Hi.
So one of the things you do, I know, is you have your own company, as Sue does, and you drive race cars. Can you tell us a little about that?
Yeah, that's a habit that I've never been able to give up, really. Since the age of 18, I've raced go-karts or cars at various stages in my life. It's something I enjoy. It's not something necessarily that I get a thrill from, which surprises everybody, but it's something that I find challenging. I enjoy the whole sort of process of competition and taking myself to, you know, my limits and beyond sometimes.
Tell me a little about your company. What does your company do?
Our company is focused on people performance. And that really pulls two elements of my career. One is having worked in motorsport and having had the wonderful opportunity of working with world champions, is getting a chance to see what is excellence for them and how they handle and manage performance. So we bring some of that learning into our business. And then on the people side, I bring my own experience from having worked in a number of companies that have grown very rapidly. Often in areas of high technology where the thing has never been made before, so we have to literally pioneer our way through manufacturing, sales, marketing, technology development, everything. So it's a whole new ball game every time.
Well, you both are doing things that are complementary, that have some of the same skill sets. Is that what brought you together in the first place? Is that how you met? How did that come about?
Yeah, I think so. Well, it came about through coaching. We're both executive coaches. And I think through discussion, we realized that we were approaching similar aspects of people development, personal development, but from two slightly different approaches, but coming to the same point. I would say my time has been more about motivation. So it's actually being in there with the people despite the fact of being the business leader, but being down there on the shop floor, in the office, wherever it is, encouraging them to make it happen. Whereas for Sue, it was much more of being an inspiration by, as you've already discussed, the things that she's achieved.
Mm-hmm.
Being able to have achieved world first is something that's truly inspiring for many.
The book's called Cope with Change at Work. And we were asked to write it by the publishers because there seemed to be a gap in the market for books that really support people who are at the receiving end of change. So,
mm-hmm.
so if you look in, if you looked up on Google the process of managing change, there's lots of books for people who have got to change other people.
Mm-hmm.
But for those that are the recipients, often those maybe in their first level jobs or early situation as a manager, they often are having change done to them. It can be external change, such as the economic conditions. It can be a new system or procedure. It can be a new boss. It could even be a new job. How do you cope with that type of change? And more, we certainly see in our work as coaches the after effects of people who haven't coped well with that type of situation. So we thought we'd make it a really practical guide in order to help people to cope with the particular situations. So each chapter focuses on one particular aspect of change, as I've just described. One chapter is starting a new job. Another chapter is a new system and procedure in your department. Another chapter is around getting a new boss, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are different subtleties to the types of change that we experience at work. And within each chapter, then, we describe how those particular situations could be dealt with. I guess the two underpinning themes are really the ability to self-manage and take responsibility. Often we see that people don't always take responsibility for change. They try to blame other people for it,
mm-hmm.
or they try to assume that somebody else should fix it for them. And actually, at the end of the day, I guess partly of what we've both learned in our careers, both in motorsport and on polar expeditions, is it's down to personal responsibility. And I think that would be one particular key message.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's absolutely spot on. Today, with the leaner businesses where there's fewer people, much more is expected of people, yet the time isn't there to give them the training and the support. So we hope that this book provides them a very practical way of looking at it. We've put case studies in, we've put exercises in. So we've really tried to lay down a book which will be appealing to a wide range of people, because everybody has different learning styles. So we hope that, again, it's something that they can get a practical benefit out of.
Attention to detail and preparation are critical both to Sue's adventures and to Clive's racing, and they say similar skills apply to the workplace.
And I know I interviewed Clive thinking about his motor racing experience. I was doing another project and studying excellence in motor racing driving instructors, as he is. And one of the things that was a particular skill that all the instructors had was that ability to focus on minute details, but to know what were the right details to focus on. You know, if there's a flag that's blowing in a particular direction because of the wind, what does that tell you? Rather than perhaps looking at the passenger that's sitting next to you that's there in the car. So even the subtleties in terms of the way the car might move, and I'm sure Clive can talk more about this than I can.
Well, your fear is always the unknown. As Sue has said, it's about preparation. And I guess there's sort of two aspects with high-speed driving. It's all about the level of grip that you have. That's the main thing that you're looking for. Although, unless, if you're driving an Indy car or Formula One, there'll be the aerodynamics. But for most of us, it's just the sheer grip that we get from our tyres. And therefore, there's two real areas. One is if it's dry, and the other if it's wet. And when it's wet, it's worse, because it's how wet.
Mm-hmm.
And it's when you hit a puddle, you don't know how deep it is, you don't know if your tyres will be pumping enough water. That's where you have to be calm. You have to be calm, you have to be able to believe that you are going to catch the car. And as we call it, stay on the black stuff, stay on the tarmac. Mm-hmm. And that's really the challenge. And the more that you do it, the more that you do become accustomed to that. Whereas with the dry, it's a different world. And I guess comparing it to what Sue has done, it's where you really are putting yourself to an extreme, because there you're pulling high G-force. Everything is given. You've committed the car to the corner at the maximum speed you believe you can do. If anything happens after that, you're probably off.
Yeah.
And then it's down to how quickly you respond. And at that stage, I often think it's an interesting debate between whether it is purely instinctive or whether it is the ability of the brain to quickly access memory and remember things that you've done before and give you the right commands that your muscles react in the appropriate way to catch the slide. And you can see examples of that, of top drivers will catch a slide as if nothing ever happened, and then you can see, you know, amateurs, they'll try to catch it and they'll just take that split second too long, g-forces are built up in the wrong direction and you're off. So it is, you know, there is a part there about experience, but it's also talent. And all of this in many respects can be compared to people at work. It might not seem as exciting, but you know, they all have their areas of talent, their areas of ability. They know when things can be stretched. And that's again why this book in part was written, because you can have your boss come down and say it can be done by X. Sometimes it can't, but the boss won't want to hear that, and that's where the skill and the bravery come in to be able to, you know, navigate through that. And that's what we try to help people do through the book.
Yeah, I think that, you know, we can all be pioneers in our own right and take steps into the unknown. What I enjoy nowadays, and I think Clive as well particularly has enjoyed, together we've stepped into the unknown in writing this book together. Mm-hmm. We've both written articles and obviously myself have written other books previously. However, having to collaborate and work together is a bit of a, you know, an adventure for both of us.
Well, you both push the envelope and then come back from that and apply what you've learned to help people who are just leading their regular lives. So thank you both. I enjoyed talking with you. I'm glad you visited with us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to The Human Beat. You can listen to or download a podcast of this program or any of the discussion programs on Coast Community Radio at coastradio.org. At the top of the webpage, click where it says On Demand and select the program of your choice from the extensive list. And join us again on the second Tuesday of next month at 9:30 a.m. for The Human Beat. I'm Roger Rocca.